Hi, and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors. I'm Kevin Glass, managing editor of Town Hall, and today I am joined by...
David Graham, politics editor at The Atlantic.
Yeah, thanks for being on with me, David. I think that we've got some interesting topics to hit on here, and I think first is kind of what was brought up by an article from Jonathan Chait yesterday, which is a theme that's been hit on fairly recently in the Obama years, and it's basically... In the course of his explanation of his experience of seeing 12 Years a Slave, which is very critically acclaimed, I haven't actually seen it, but he goes on to say that there is a lot of racial undertones to conservatives' criticisms of Obama. And I wanted to kind of get your take on that and your take on what might be undergirding some of these criticisms of conservatives in the Obama years.
Well, I think one thing that the sort of meta debate about this column brings out is whether or not there is in fact any racial element to what conservatives are saying. Clearly, some people are taking it that way. I think a lot of people on the left are taking it that way. And if nothing else, that seems to be what's, I hate to use a phrase like a teachable moment, but like maybe there's something to be learned from the fact that we see that obviously liberals are imputing a racial motive to all sorts of things that are said about Obama, whether they are or not, or a borderline, you know, it's what they're seeing, I think. And that was what I'm seeing from this. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think that something that's kind of inhibited conservative thinking on, I mean, a lot of structural racism today is mm-hmm. the confusion in our lexicon. So if I call someone a racist, what that's popularly understood to mean is that they have an overt dislike of other races, or they have an overt thinking that others are inferior or things like that. And that's mm-hmm. not really the kind of racism that we're grappling with anymore. And certainly there are overt racists out there, lots of them. But the kind of thrust of a lot of these criticisms is that it's not mm-hmm. overt racism. It's structural racism. Right. It's deeper than that. So when you say that something normally, and I think that progressives are right about this, you know, that there is a lot of, I think Chait called it residue from the slavery era that infects our society and how we operate. But when someone is called a racist or someone's actions or words are called racist, what they immediately imagine they're being called as someone who dislikes black people just by the fact right. of them being black. And I think that mm-hmm. that distinction is something that inhibits conservatives' thinking and their ability to move forward. But I think it also is something that needs more clarification mm-hmm. when you're making that kind of accusation.
Sure. So I saw something, I think this was you, although if it wasn't, too many tweets, but somebody was tweeting that the structural racism explanation would be a lot more convincing if it wasn't always a conservative case, right? It seems like whenever folks like Chait make this argument, it always applies to a conservative pundit or a conservative politician and never to a liberal. Was that you?
I might have tweeted some things along those lines, but yeah.
So I'm trying to think of examples of, I was wondering if you had examples of places where it looks like liberals are committing the same error of structural racism.
Well, there was a good...
Or being blind to it.
Right, there was a good post from John Chait in the past that kind of was brought up as well, where there was, you know, this photo of Obama in the White House early in his presidency, where he's kicking back, he's got his legs up on the desk, mm-hmm. and someone accused, like, the popularity of this photo of having racial connotations, saying that he's, mm-hmm. You know, in the same way that Chait was accusing Quinn Hillier of doing this, saying that this was showing that he's haughty or he's lazy or something like that.
Right.
And I think that there are problematic criticisms that some conservatives make of President Obama. But I think that they kind of knee-jerk react into thinking that they're falsely being accused of racism mm-hmm. in most cases. And sometimes right. that's right, and sometimes that's wrong. But conservatives kind of do need to realize Well, yeah, conservators need to realize that there are these structural factors at play. But at the same time, like you were saying, kind of the asymmetrical aspect of this, there was this dust up on Chris Hayes' show a while back where he claimed that, you know, racists are of only one ideological movement in the United States. And I think that that is a problematic attitude that progressives have. That, you know, not that there are no progressive racists or liberal racists or whatever, but that the problem is so asymmetrical that it's all, that it's not even worth it to address the problem of liberals who are racists or progressives who are racists. And that's the reason that they're kind of calling out all of the conservatives.
That seems to distract from the structural racism problem too. If you're sort of, if you're, you're focused on picking out who the racists are and naming and shaming, you're probably not really dealing with the, you know, questions like, you know, disproportionate arrest rates or whatever, right? You're too busy on a witch hunt.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So then, I mean, I see Chait and Hayes are sort of working at cross purposes there, it seems. If, does that make sense?
Yes. But I do think that, conservatives kind of do need to realize, and Tim Carney had a good response to Chait saying that there are a lot of structural factors at play that conservatives kind of try to brush aside. And I think that when it comes to, you know, overt versus structural racism here, conservatives tend to think that, and actually this kind of ties into a minor flap that happened when the Republican National Committee over the weekend tweeted about Rosa Parks' role in quote-unquote ending racism. And conservatives tend to think that racism is less of a concern and maybe not even that much of a concern because there is legal equal treatment under the law. That's what conservatives are generally focused on, is kind of legalize, is making the law colorblind. That if you make the law colorblind, racism will go away. And if we just, if we, and for the most part, we've made laws colorblind. For the most part, I'm not going to make any huge claims there. But,
sure, on the major issues, school segregation, for example.
The civil rights movement equalizes a lot of treatment under the law. And conservatives think that once you do that, and once you start, stop talking about racism, it'll go away, which I think is a wrong attitude to have about racism, and that it needs to be, and conservatives in particular need to be more proactive in combating racism, and that that's not necessarily advocating for government solutions to racism, but it does mean education, or it means conversations, or things like that.
Right. The other thing that this all brings out, that rereading Chait's column today, is this issue of disaggregation. So it is both the case that there's something pretty problematic about, you know, referring to a black man as uppity or haughty, and also the case that Barack Obama may be arrogant, and it's totally possible to see him as arrogant in a way that is not necessarily related to color, right? And since we're dealing with a single example of a politician, and there are relatively few, I think, high-profile black politicians, and only one black president, it's hard to separate criticisms that are targeted at Obama specifically from criticisms that, you know, have a different pedigree. And I think that's why, to me, that's one reason there are so many battles over things about Obama, and all these semantic battles about what does this particular sentence mean, what is this writer trying to say? Is it, they say they're saying one thing, but do they really mean this? And I think the lack of much data to go on and other examples and a sample size makes it tough to see.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that conservatives don't take into account the magnitude of the power of words and framing and things like that, right? So, I mean, the word uppity, if someone wrote a column criticizing President Obama and literally called him uppity, I don't think that anyone would have a problem saying that that's incredibly problematic, maybe overtly racist, even if that person is not aware of, you know, the stigma around calling African-Americans uppity or haughty or whatever. I don't think that conservatives kind of get that, you know? They say that, mm-hmm. oh, it's your fault for bringing race back into this. Mm-hmm. President Obama is clearly, you know, very arrogant, so why are you taking issue with this word? But I don't, mm-hmm. I think for the most part, conservatives are aware of things like that, but they're not aware of more kind of structural background issues. I mean, like, uh-huh. President Bush was compared to a monkey many, many times. Right. You would not do that. It would be worse to compare President Obama to a monkey than compare mm-hmm. President Bush to a monkey.
Right. And occasionally you'll hear people pushing back on that. Well, this is a double standard. It's like affirmative action. It's not fair. Why can't we do one for the other? If it's okay for one politician, why isn't it the same? Which seems like the sort of, the absurdist reduction of the making the law colorblind and equalizing, right? On the one hand, you have, it makes sense for, to get rid of segregation and so on and so forth. And if you take that colorblind all the way across the board, you end up saying, well, if we called Bush a monkey, why can't we call Obama a monkey? Do those seem connected to you? I think there's I don't think everybody draws this connection. And I don't think I buy it, but I think there's you can draw a line between those two things.
Right. And at some, I don't know if it will ever go away, you know? Mm-hmm. And at some point, like we all recognize it would be horrendous to call President Obama monkey or uppity or any of the kind of stigmatized things that have gone along with being black in America for, mm-hmm. For as long as those have been stigmas. Mm-hmm. But Chait was kind of criticizing Hillier for you not using those exact words, but kind of saying that mm-hmm. that sentiment is where his criticism is coming from.
Right.
And he said, I think he said, you know, Hillier was not aware of how he was cloaking his argument in racial terms.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think Chait was more problematic in saying that Quinn Hillier is the, you know, ideological descendant of slave drivers.
Right.
Which gets, mm-hmm. I think that's way too far. I think that saying mm-hmm. that conservatives are unaware of how structural racism still is a huge factor and how it's important to be more careful about word choices is different from saying they're, you know, the heirs of slave owners.
So now why do you think conservatives are less attuned to that? Certainly it's not for lack of liberals calling racism.
Right. Why? I mean, to a certain extent, they want racism to not be a factor, and they want to, mm-hmm. conservatives believe in a merit-based society, right? Where
right.
there's equality of opportunity for everyone, mm-hmm. which I would say is not the case, but it's an important goal to be working towards. Right. But, and racism is another thing, is a thing that is really hard, if not impossible, to ever get rid of, and will always be a reason to try and, selectively give groups legs up in the, you know, meritocracy. Because if you have a true meritocracy, you like to believe that anyone of all races has equal opportunity. Yeah. And racism is something that would inhibit that, especially in a country where we have a majority of the people are of one race.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to what extent do you think the, relative whiteness of the Republican Party is a problem now? Or not a problem, but a root of that.
Right.
If there were more black Republicans, do you think more conservative pundits would be more attuned to that? Surely.
I'm not sure.
Yeah? Interesting. Why is that?
Well, we see black conservatives kind of used for tokenism, basically, in the Republican Party.
Uh-huh. Right.
And we saw, actually, at the 2012 political conventions, there. I remember someone did an analysis of people of color on given speaking roles at each mm-hmm. convention, and Republicans had more. They had more, mm-hmm. I don't remember if they had more women, but they had more Hispanics, they had more black people.
Right.
And to a certain extent, when you have someone like Alan West, who is a black conservative, who goes out and says, you know, racism is not a problem, or, you know, I don't know if Alan West has actually said these things, but
sure,
someone who says, you know, that the structural racism that Democrats and the culture of victimhood or whatever are not huge concerns. Republicans like to hold that up and say, see, this is why Democrats are wrong about these things. It's different.
Right, you get Thomas Sowell saying some of those things, for example.
Right. And we actually see people like Colin Powell, who has said many things to distance himself from the conservative movement in the past few years.
Yeah.
But he says he acknowledges the difficulties in combating racism. And he's more ostracized from the Republican Party for it. Like, that's one of the things that has distanced himself from the Republican Party. It's not something that Republicans have kind of internalized. So, yeah, I don't think more black conservatives in and of itself would help the Republican Party in this way.
Right. Yeah. It seems to me that's another example of sort of the problem of disaggregating, because you have a conservative white, liberal black dynamic that, although exaggerated, I think ends up playing into this. Although it's funny looking at this, where we have Chait, a white guy, responding to Quinn Hillier, a white guy, and then we are discussing this. So it's all a little meta, I think.
Yes. But I think hopefully, you know, we can. I mean, I want the Republican Party to acknowledge, and conservatives in general to acknowledge, that racism is still a thing that needs to be thought about, fought against in modern society. But I also think, so Quinn Hillier wrote a response today that was not well received in my Twitter feed, just generally. But I think that one of the large problems with what Chait wrote and about Quinn Hillier in particular, is kind of identifying them in, you know, this grand racist tradition in the United States. And that's a problem of identifying what the problem is, right? If you, if you misidentify the problem, it's harder to get solutions. And saying in the Chris Hayes way, or I don't know if John Chait thinks this, but saying that, you know, this is a problem confined to the other side. I think that is a huge, that is something holding conservatives back and holding progressives back.
Right. It's hard to see what the benefit is of drawing that distinction. Even if it were 100% true, I'm not sure what benefit you have in saying it's only these guys who are the problem, right? It's a team-based approach rather than a sort of solution-based approach. I'm speaking jargon. But I think that's true, right? It makes it into a litmus test. It makes it into just a dividing issue instead of actually dealing with whatever the questions are and whether or not it's these things are, well, what the structural racism problems.
Right. And to a certain extent, it's kind of used as a cudgel. You say, you know, you're conservative, you think these things, but you're also on the side of all these racists. And to that extent, that plays back into what I started with, which is confusing the kind of overt versus structural racism argument. It says, you know, there are all these people who don't recognize what white privilege is in the conservative movement, and you're with them, and maybe you're an overt racist because of that.
So do you think we'll get any closer to understanding that distinction through this flap?
I mean, I would hope so, but these flaps have been going on for a long time, and to a large extent, this is kind of just a confined to the Blogo world. You know, we're not having this kind of larger discussion. And I think something that is true, and I've seen written, is that conservatives' attitude on racism has regressed a little bit in the Obama years. And I think there are two factors for that. One is that conservatives used the media's hype of how Obama would give us a post-racial society to say, well, we elected Obama, so now all these racists, all these problems of racism have gone away, because that's what you said would happen if we elected
Obama. You guys in the liberal media said so. Right. We're just taking your metric.
Right. And I think that the false accusations of racism directed at people who criticize the president. And not that there, there are many racists who criticize the president and do so in a racist way.
But not all criticism is racist.
But not all criticism is racist. And obviously when you have a black president, there's going to be more... There's going to be more people saying you're criticizing him because you're a racist when that is not the case. So not it's not that it's not like and this is something conservatives think as well. It's not like false accusations of racism are not worse than actual racism, but they make it harder to but they make it harder to progress on the actual issue of racism.
Right.
And I think that that's kind of the problem that the conservative movement has had in the Obama era.
To grappling with which the failing to recognize that false accusations are not as bad as racism, or having to grapple with both.
Both.
I see.
Yeah.
Huh. So you know what happens then in a post well not post Obama but a post Obama presidency world, where he's no longer the figurehead of the Democratic Party. Does that allow? Sort of more frankness? Does it help to move forward after those regressions?
I think the opportunity will be there, certainly. I think that the right kind of black Republicans would help. It's not just black Republicans in general. If we had 40 Allen Wests in the Senate who are Republicans, that would not, I don't think, move the conservative movement forward. I think that having black conservatives who acknowledge that racism is and will continue to be problems, push for solutions that aren't necessarily government solutions, but someone who says, you know, structural racism is a problem, affirmative action is not necessarily the solution, we need to be more cognizant of this and find better solutions. Would that kind of person identifying as a Republican would be helpful for the Republican Party and for the conservative movement?
Right. It seems like a lot. Well, I'm trying to think of other examples outside of the case of sort of affirmative action where, you know, good examples of structural racism where there might be a conflict between the acknowledgement of a structural racism and then the, you know, the ideological goal where, like... But I'm failing to think of good examples. Like, what are the what are our other great cases of structural racism that need to be grappled with? I mean, I guess the justice system, for example. What would be a non-government solution to disparate arrest rates or disparate sentencing?
Right. I mean, and urban poverty in general. And this actually, we might talk about this in a little bit, but this is kind of related to President Obama's economic speech yesterday. He made a colorblind case for fighting urban poverty and pushing for economic opportunity and equality, saying that, you know, I think he explicitly said, you know, poverty is not a black problem in America. It's an American problem. So there's a lot more to be done there. And conservatives would like to say that their, you know, ways of combating poverty and helping people up into the middle class are also race blind. But if what they're saying is true, it would disproportionately help minorities because minorities are disproportionately poor.
It seems to me that the difficulty for many conservatives in acknowledging structural racism has tended to cede the policy field on the solutions to the left.
Right.
So there are conservative solutions and policies and proposals on a lot of these topics, but there are, in the sort of general discourse, because liberals have talked about it more, it's much more clear what the liberal policy solutions are.
Right.
And you don't get a lot of conversation, so it's hard to even have a debate about what the better solution is if you only have the liberal solution on the table.
Right. The only policy I can think of that is sometimes explicitly pushed for on the basis of racial equality is school vouchers, especially in urban areas, obviously, on which, you know, conservatives are for giving vouchers to poor minorities. I mean, poor people in general, but especially because they're implemented in urban areas, they're going to be even more disproportionately minorities. And that...
Well, and we had this fascinating case of Eric Holder versus Bobby Jindal on school vouchers just, what was this, a few weeks ago.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And that's kind of something that conservatives I've seen are very comfortable arguing on race grounds when it comes to school vouchers. And basically on every other issue kind of try to back away from the race aspect.
Right.
I wanted to move now to something less racism, possibly more sexism. But Martin Bashir was fired from MSNBC yesterday.
Or resigned.
Perhaps resigned, yes. From MSNBC yesterday, based on his comments about Sarah Palin, which seemed off the cuff. I don't know if they were scripted, whatever. But about defecating in Sarah Palin's mouth and how, and not just that, she's a prominent Republican, but she is a woman who kind of gets, I don't know if it's disproportionately poor treatment by the left. And I probably wouldn't say that it's based on her gender, but Martin Bashir might disagree now because he has been dismissed based on his Sarah Palin comments. And I'm not sure that would have happened if he criticized a man in that way.
Yeah. I mean, I'm also not sure he would have criticized a man in that way. I mean, who knows? Hard to tell, but it's such a weird comment. It's hard to imagine. I think, based on no particularly clear, three examples, but just on sort of the totality, I think Palin does tend to get somewhat disparate treatment, and she gets sort of caricatured as kind of a ditz. And I think her kind of word salad soundbites doesn't help. But I think the treatment is disproportionate. It's hard to imagine Martin Bashir saying that about Ted Cruz, for example.
Yes, it is, yeah. And you can, I wouldn't do this, but you can troll Twitter for horrendously sexist things said about Sarah Palin.
Sure.
And those are probably coming from self-identified progressives.
Right.
So, and I don't know if conservatives at large would get on board with that. I don't know. I mean, because like the Che thing, conservatives would like to say criticism of President Obama in many ways, and calling him arrogant particularly is not racist. But would a conservative say that people who attack Sarah Palin, call her a ditz, call her a bimbo, are they being sexists in a way that, they're not fully appreciating the history of sexism in America, in which, women were told, your brains don't function on the level of men, so you can't be a leader or a politician or something like that.
I don't know. I mean, it's weird, I think, in particular, to hear this coming from a place like MSNBC, which makes a very visible effort to talk about these sort of things. It's weird to see. I don't know. I'm not sure the lack of awareness works as well. I also think that the sort of gender dynamic works. People's awareness of the gender dynamic is different from their awareness of race. I think it's easy for people to be segregated by race, if not legally, just geographically.
Right.
But that's not, and culturally, but that's obviously not true of men and women.
Yeah. That's true. And I would actually say MSNBC has been consistent. So conservatives went after MSNBC for saying, you employ these people who say horrible things, and Alec Baldwin was similar. He had a homophobic outburst at, was it a paparazzi?
That
came to light, and he was let go from MSNBC. Mm-hmm. And conservatives kind of seized on this to say, hey, your standard is if a conservative says something like this, they have to publicly apologize and probably lose their job over it. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's the progressive standard on outbursts like this. And to MSNBC's credit, they followed their own, what, you know, the standard that conservatives said they had. They followed it. They let, mm-hmm. they fired Alec Baldwin. Martin Bashir resigned. But then we saw conservatives kind of defending. I saw right. conservatives defending, you know.
I saw it as well.
Bashir and Baldwin saying that they shouldn't have lost their jobs over their comments.
Mm-hmm. It's the, I mean, it's similar to the argument against hate crimes and the idea of hate speech, right? You know, we're gonna argue with you and we're gonna disagree when you say things like this, but there shouldn't be a ban on it,
right?
And I think that's, I think progressives don't always do a very good job of defending that and differentiating between things that are maybe deplorable, but ought not to mean that you are muzzled or disappeared. I think conservatives do a much better job of recognizing that difference and of defending it. And I think this is a great case of that. Before Bashir resigned, I saw a lot of pretty strident and I think justified criticism of the things he'd said. And it was really interesting to see what happened afterwards. And I saw the same thing you did of a lot of people on the right standing up for Bashir in a way I didn't anticipate.
Yeah. And like I said, to MSNBC's credit, they followed the standard.
It took them a long time, though. It was a weird, slow-burning scandal for the comments to come and so far before the actual departure. They open themselves up to the risk of looking like they're responding to public opinion more than they are to standards of propriety.
Yes. What I actually saw, Adam Carolla, he does his own podcast, obviously mm-hmm. a Hollywood person. He claimed that it was kind of open knowledge that if Alec Baldwin had good ratings, he would not have been fired. But his, mm-hmm. I don't remember how many episodes of the show he had, two or three at most, right? Before mm-hmm. he was placed on leave and then ultimately dismissed.
Right.
But if he had, as far as the entertainment industry knows, they know that you can't survive something like that if you don't have good ratings. And Alec Baldwin did not have good ratings. But possibly
sure.
he would have survived if, you know, he had rejuvenated the Friday night lineup on MSNBC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's, I mean, I have no insider knowledge, but it makes logical sense. It's much easier to fire somebody who's underperforming than somebody who's your star.
Right. Right.
I mean, look how long it took to fire Olbermann.
Yeah. And, I mean,
who,
a lot of that...
Who didn't do the same... It wasn't always the same sort of comments, although sometimes he said things that struck me as over the line, but it was, you know, the constant battles with the network and so on and so forth. But, it took a long time for him to actually get out the door.
Yeah, but he was getting very good ratings, and maybe that's why it took him a while. And mm-hmm. it kind of came out afterwards that it was maybe more of a behind-the-scenes thing, because he is apparently notoriously impossible to work with, or mm-hmm. for, or any of that. And you know, to MSNBC's credit, they did get rid of him eventually, mm-hmm. and they do kind of follow their own standards on what is acceptable to say to keep your job and what's not acceptable to keep your mm-hmm. job.
Yeah. It seems weird to me, sort of from a branding perspective, to have a channel that has, Chris Hayes, for example, and also has Martin Bashir saying things like these. It strikes me as difficult to maintain an operation where you've got that kind of disparate types of discourse going on.
Possibly. I mean, I would say that Fox News' hosts are more ideologically diverse than they're typically given credit for. I mm-hmm. mean, you have Shep Smith's hour right before Bill O'Reilly's hour, right before Sean Hannity's hour. And, I mean, Bill O'Reilly... is kind of not on Sean Hannity's level, but they're still, you know, explicitly mm-hmm. conservative commentators. And Shep Smith is pretty much a standard journalist.
Right. Yeah, Bashir, I feel like, as we see, is less trying to walk the straight journalist line, or was less trying to walk the straight journalist line. It's more a question of you can either build yourself as... having serious political discussions, or you can have this kind of shock jock approach to folks right. like Sarah Palin. But it's tough to combine both of those things in fairly short order.
Right. Yeah. And MSNBC in general has kind of transitioned out of the shock jock mode mm-hmm. by,
right.
I mean, it took, I don't remember who was in that spot before, but, you know, they went from Keith Olbermann in the 8 p.m. hour to Chris Hayes in the 8 p.m. hour, mm-hmm. which is a vastly different kind of show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that probably wraps us up for today. Do you have any last comments?
I don't know. I think that probably covers it. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks a lot for being on. And tune in next time on Rational Actors. Thanks a lot.
Take care.